Okay, I'm feeling an insane amount of power with the clock down there and the bell. I can't tell you how exciting it is for me. I think that's something to do with my personality. Nonetheless, welcome to panel two, which is called Marketing and Media for Authors, with Fremantle Press Marketing and Communications Manager Claire Miller. And she is chairing a panel with Lisa Sheeran, James Foley and Tim Coronel.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Georgia. I'll just jump right in and introduce each person because we've got a lot of ground to cover and not a huge amount of time. So Lisa Sheeran, to my left here, is an author, blogger, journalist, copywriter and social media mentor at Hancock Creative. Lisa teaches worthy causes how to grow their impact by telling their story, both in real life and online. She also practices what she preaches with her blog, The Notorious Mum, which has morphed into her first work of fiction, A Beginner's Guide to Running, which I believe is out soon. Is that correct?
It's at the printers.
It's at the printers, so look out for that. Tim Coronel is the general manager of the Small Press Network. He's a publishing consultant and a lecturer at the University of Melbourne's Master of Publishing and Communications. He has been involved in the book industry one way or another for over 30 years, variously as a bookseller, a journalist and a commentator on the book trade, a writer, editor, publicist, marketer, and as a publisher of books, magazines and online content. Our final guest is James Foley. He's the ultimate substitute here instead of Liz Bursky. James is an award-winning children's author and illustrator. His books include In the Lion, My Dead Bunny, The Last Viking and The Last Viking Returns. His latest junior graphic novels, the Estinka Inc. series, are gaining a dedicated audience among young people and include the titles Brobot, Dungzilla and Gastronauts. James is also an ambassador for Books in Homes and Room to Read Australia, and he is one of the country's most sought-after authors for events. So please welcome them all. James and Lisa, you're probably going to approach the idea of an author brand very differently or slightly differently. Lisa, what would you say is an author brand and why might an author need one?
An author brand is how you portray yourself out there in the world. So it's your public persona. I believe that you do need one. You know, it's not absolutely essential, but it's going to help your cause if you do have a brand. I think there's a lot of negative connotations around brand. You think of big corporates and you think of shiny stories and a bit of fake news. I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think when we're talking about creating author brands, we're talking about putting yourself out there and telling your own stories and building up a really genuine, authentic community based on the person that you're putting out there. So I think it can be a really positive thing. It does rely on you putting yourself out there a little bit, but it can really help with building that engaged community. I think the literary landscape has changed such a lot that you can't just rely on your book. However good it is, you can't just rely on that to go out there in the world and sell copies. If you're there helping it along the way with a bit of a brand, then that can only be a good thing from my point of view, as long as you're doing it honestly and openly and authentically.
And what about you, James? You like putting yourself out there?
I think whether you try to have an author brand or not, you're going to have one anyway. So you have to try and take control of it. And I don't think it's something that you need to, as you were saying, I don't think it's something you need to fake. I think it needs to be very close to just authentically who you are. I think the more that you know who you are, the better you are at doing your job of writing and illustrating. You can be more honest with it, but also the easier it is to put yourself out there. And your public persona is not going to be exactly yourself. It's going to be kind of a heightened version of yourself, but it should be pretty close, I think, because people can smell if you're faking it, if you're not being who you are. And then there's the surface levels of it too, like it's how you present yourself in terms of what you wear and your haircut and stuff like that. That's things you might want to consider too. I wear a lot of blue checks just because it's really comfortable to wear and because I'm a dad and it's kind of our unofficial dad uniform to wear these. But also I just have like a wardrobe full of different blue checks. I just wear a different one to every talk that I come to. That's my brand, blue checks.
My brand's loud socks. Well, I've always got loud socks. So yeah.
And Tim, what are the key marketing and media things that authors should be learning now? What are their skills that they should have?
I'll reiterate the thing about authenticity. Be yourself. I think we'll probably move on to talk more about social media later on, but you have to be comfortable with the platforms that you use. There's no point jumping in to Facebook, for example, and not realising how that community and ecosystem works. So, yes, utilising social media that's out there, utilising the networks that are there, and the previous session, I learned things that I didn't know about so many opportunities here in Western Australia and comparable ones that are in the other states. So, yeah, writing can be a lonely thing, and the main thing is there's a point when you need to get out and do stuff. And when you do, there's actually lots of help out there. And you need help to find the help. So that's the main thing. Engage would be the short answer.
Now, yesterday we had 35 new and emerging authors in a workshop. And at the end of it, some people are saying, but why are we learning about marketing and pitching now? And we haven't got our books published yet. So at what point do each of you think an author needs to start thinking about their marketing or their media presence or their author brand?
From my point of view, I think it's really important to start building that audience and building that community from day dot. So when you start writing, you know, put that writing out there in the world. That's why I love social media, because you can almost use it as your testing ground. You put ideas out there, see how people respond, and then you're naturally going to build your audience. So like attracts like. Take people on the journey with you of publishing a book. If they are really engaged, they'll be cheering you on from the outset as you make mistakes. And if you're vulnerable and you admit to those mistakes and take them on that journey, I think they're going to be really open to that. That's certainly been my experience. You know, I had people backing me for a book that they thought was actually a beginner's literal guide to running, because they were cheering me on and they were part of my community and they'd been involved from the outset when it had become, was a seed of an idea, to now when it's at the printers, they followed me on that journey. So the earlier you can get an audience on board and engage with you, the better.
And James, how do you balance that with writing?
In terms of time management? Mm. Goodness knows, I'm still figuring that out myself. I think, I know from experience that at the time that a book of mine is due to come out, I'm probably not going to have a lot of time to organise any publicity stuff. It needs to be done weeks, months in advance, particularly if I've got a book launch here, maybe I've got one north of the river and south of the river, and maybe I'm going to Sydney or Melbourne to do something there as well. I'm usually packing in a lot around the time that a book's coming out. So I need to start planning well before. And being an illustrator too, I'll start sharing rough illustrations and process stuff and finish illustrations at least sort of 2 months before the book is due to come out. That's just what I found works for me. And then as it gets closer to the actual release date, I might do something that's a bit more targeted, like for the last book, Gastronauts, I just got friends to come up with a whole bunch of really bad puns about the book. So it's about kids who are scientists shrinking themselves down and going into the gastrointestinal system of a baby in a tiny submarine. So they were coming up with all these slogans like, Gastronauts, it's going viral, and Gastronauts, share gastro with your friends, and all these gross things like that. And so I just made these little square images that were I could share on Instagram and Twitter and whatever, and just so that I'm promoting my book, but it's funny. So hopefully there's some buy-in. People aren't just getting sick of seeing it over and over. So I prepare all that well before, so that when the book's coming out and I'm focused on other events, I'm not stressing out too much going, I forgot to promote my book.
And Tim, you've worked with must be dozens of authors. When would you say they need to start looking at their own promotion?
Definitely. I mean, I'd take it the other way and say the very worst time to start thinking about or particularly start talking about your book is when it's out. You know, hi, my book's out, go and buy it. Oh, I had no idea. Yeah, so definitely, yeah, work it in from the start. If you're a writer, pretty much by definition, you're disciplined. You're going to have set aside time. You're going to be dealing with editors and designers and print schedules. So, yeah, marketing publicity has to fit into that schedule as well. The other thing to say is that, again, there's help out there. You don't have to do it on your own. If you're with a publisher, your publisher is going to assist you to do that. But if you're doing it yourself as a self-publisher and you're not comfortable around the marketing and publicity aspects, you can hire people to help you do that and help you guide you along the way. Mm. You do have to put the work in yourself, but there are lots and lots of ex-publishing publicists and marketers out there who offer suites of services to self-publishing writers. Use their expertise.
And I think what we're sort of touching on here is word of mouth, which is still the main thing that sells books, is somebody telling somebody else about a great book. So, Tim, what are the kinds of things that new and emerging authors can do to start recruiting ambassadors for their books, people like librarians or booksellers or the media? What are the kinds of things they can do?
Your local booksellers and librarians should already know who you are and should be your friends. You should be part of the book world. There's not much point sitting in your garret or in your garage or in your basement thinking that, you know, you're going to get discovered. So, yes, you should be known in your local bookshop. You should be buying books. You should be going to book events, getting to know other writers. That's the way you build those networks. Writers' centres, writers' groups, just reading groups, book groups. Be a part of it all. And similarly with libraries. Libraries are a wonderful resource that often when you are a child or when you have younger children, you use libraries a lot. People, adults, don't often utilise their libraries enough. So, utilise your libraries, get to know your people in your libraries. And again, most libraries hold events, go to events as someone who's in the crowd. And that way you can start talking about what you're doing and what you're developing.
And James, I think you've found your network of fellow authors really useful. Can you talk us through that?
So at least in children's publishing and children's books here in Perth, we have a fantastic community called the SCBWI, the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. I see a few in the audience. Can you put your hand up if you're a member of Squibby? How you doing, people? So these are our sleeper agents within the organisation here. Squibby is fantastic, and it's how I got my start. So it was started in the States a long time ago. There's 70 chapters around the world, but we have a great WA-based chapter. There were some people who already published who were there at the start, like Norman and Diane Wolfer and Fran Elisak. Then I came in as a pre-published person and learnt from them. Norman took me under his wing. I met him through Squibby and we started working on a book together. Lots of other people have got their breaks through Squibby. I know Carly's got a break through that. I know Rebecca's got some connections through that. Lots of people have met editors through events that organisation runs, as well as just the community support. The other thing is we've got the Children's Book Council, which is Australia-wide. We've got a great WA chapter of that. And every year they have a Night with Our Stars in March, which is an event for people who've had a book published in the last year. And you get to go and talk about your book for like 2 minutes into a room full of librarians and school teachers, and you can network that way and get gigs. And there's conferences in Sydney for SCBWI and just heaps of events like that. The more you go to, the more people you meet, the more you learn, and the more opportunities you have.
Lisa, can you talk us through the crowdfunding aspect of your book?
Oh, absolutely. So I launched a Kickstarter campaign to raise the funds to publish my book. It was very, very straightforward, bearing in mind that I had already built up a very engaged community beforehand. That's why I'm always banging on about building up that audience, so that if you build it, they will come. So I launched a Kickstarter, taking again everyone on this journey of publishing a book, and set a goal of $5,000 with the promise of a big party at the end of it if we got there. And we got to $8,500 quite quickly and quite easily. And again, that was people taking a punt on a book that they didn't actually know what was it about. It's called A Beginner's Guide to Running, and like I say, they actually thought it was about running.
Were they disappointed when they found out what it was about?
Probably.
But it was an expensive party, so that was all forgotten.
Yeah. So I can't recommend Kickstarter highly enough. You do need to spend the time, build up that community. Social media, really, it is what it says on the tin. These avenues are absolutely essential. You have to do them, and then third on the list is to build up those networks online using social media, joining the Facebook groups, you know, in your topic. Facebook groups, Facebook pages, LinkedIn, Twitter, establishing some media contacts. All of those things are so important, and they just back up. They back up what Tim and James said.
And so now that they've helped you publish the book, what do they get in terms of the book itself? Are they now your potential buyers? Or?
Well, they have actually bought a book. They've bought it. So before it's even been printed, we've sold, I think it's 185 copies, which is, you know, not to be sniffed at. And then hopefully they'll be the ambassadors for the product as it goes out, and then they'll be able to spread the word. And they got a lot of incentives along the way with the Kickstarter campaign. So there was silly things like, for $70, I'd bake them a chocolate brownie and hand deliver it. But again, it's my brand. You know, I can't testify to the quality of the brownie, but they know that I'm good for it. It's just about having a bit of fun. That's who I am. It's not that dissimilar to who I am in real life, the public persona, and they're invested. And they kind of feel like friends, which sounds a bit naff to say, but it's true. So, yeah, they got a book and they got buy-in and they get a party.
Thank you, Lisa. So this is really a question for James and Tim, and it's a question about working with your publisher and making the most out of your publisher's networks as well. So what do you need to think about or come armed with when you're about to work on a marketing campaign with a publisher?
Well, I work pretty closely with Claire a lot. She probably regrets giving me her mobile number. Because I call her a lot when I have a book coming out. One thing that we did recently for Gastronauts when it came out was Fremantle Press doesn't distribute the books themselves, they distribute through Penguin. So they enlisted Penguin's resources to find some booksellers over east around Melbourne who'd be interested in having me as part of a tour. So I wouldn't have had those connections myself. I'm trying to build them myself, but I can't get over to Melbourne all the time. So it was fantastic that Frio had that connection. Also, Frio is connected to all the local writers' festivals in WA and pitches all of their authors to those festivals. Your publishers are absolutely vital when they're looking after you, which Frio does, which is great.
Yeah, I second that. And, I mean, another thing that a good publisher will ask an author, again, at hopefully a very early stage, is who do you know? What sort of networks do you already have? And it mightn't be directly related to your book, but it might be what clubs are you a member of? Are you involved in Rotary or Probus or, you know, something like that? Because anybody who you know is potentially audience for your book, and they can help you spread the word about it. They can post reviews of the book on Goodreads or other online sources that can help get the word out. A sensible publisher will be asking an author from a very early stage what they can do themselves. And you do hear criticism from authors who say, my publisher didn't support me, they didn't back my book enough. Reality is that you know, books have a very limited lifespan, and nowadays budgets are very, very tight. So a lot of the work is put back onto authors to support what the publisher is doing. So you can't sit back and wait for the phone to ring with your publicist saying, oh, I've arranged all these things for you. So the more you can do as a writer to get opportunities for yourself, and that might be doing a daytime talk at a local Probus during the week or at a local library, depending upon who the audience for your book is. And, you know, authors can organise those things independently and then involve their publisher, involve their local bookshop in coming along to do the sales for the book. So there's lots and lots of different things. And it's a good symbiotic relationship.
Mm-hmm. Doing this as a job, you just got to kind of know from the outset that marketing and publicity is just part of the job. It's not just the romantic ideal of writing on your own in a beautiful sunlit room with a cat on your lap and blah, blah, blah. I mean, it can be that, but not all the time. You do have to just do this marketing stuff. It's just part of the gig.
It really is a partnership, I think, between the publisher and the author, and it's about communication. So we love it when people organise things and let us know they're organising things so that we can support that as much as possible, and vice versa. Lisa, I get some authors who come into my office and go, do I have to be on social media? Do I really have to be?
You don't have to be, but you really should be. You have to fish where the fish are. So where are your readers hanging out? Where are the people who are going to buy your book? Where are they? Well, you can get out and meet them one by one, which is going to take you a long time, and you're going to have to track them down. Or social media, they're all just sitting there waiting for you. So I do think it's an essential. I think it's probably your number one marketing tool because it's the place where you can really be yourself as well. You don't have to do the hard sell. Again, it comes back down to that brand, that authentic brand. 94% of social media users are on Facebook. So for everyone that sort of poo-poos Facebook and says, no, it's not necessary, chances are your readers are there. Even if you're, you know, a really niche market, they're still there. They're in a very niche group on Facebook. And you can tap that up and there you go. There's your readership. It is an essential part of your marketing journey, I feel. No, you don't have to do it, but you should.
And what do you think are the best platforms?
Again, that depends on who your readers are and what you want to achieve with that. As I said, Facebook is 94% of social media users, so all these stories of Facebook being on the decline, not quite yet. That's where people hang out. And you do have access to groups on Facebook, which are very, very useful. I'm sure you use a lot of them for the, you know, children's publishing would have its own group. You know, find those like-minded people and hang out there and get to know your readers. Facebook is great. It's hard to get traction, but you're all storytellers and stories are prioritised on Facebook above promotional, above selling your actual physical book. If you can get on Facebook and tell a great story, you will still get your message out there. And you can use Facebook successfully without spending any money. And that's another misconception as well. People think that you need a lot of money on Facebook. If you want to flog something, you need money. I've never spent a dollar on Facebook in my own author promotion. Not a dollar. And I've built up a community just by storytelling. So that would be my recommendation. I know it sounds like I'm sort of prioritising Facebook. That tends to be where my readership hangs out. Instagram is also really useful. And then if you're looking at the more professional network, so maybe networking with, you know, booksellers, librarians, publishers, media, LinkedIn and Twitter are fantastic. So totally different audience, but they do have their own value as well. So Facebook and Instagram for your readers as a rule, and LinkedIn and Twitter for those more professional relationships.
So, James, social media can feel like a full-time job, perhaps, sometimes. How do you choose which one to focus on?
I think social media is a problem because it's designed to be addictive. So you have to find ways to limit your use so that you can still get work done. Friends of mine who figured out how to do that, they install apps in their phone where they're only allowed to access certain other apps, like social media apps, once a day, and then it blocks them. Or they'll do things like they'll set their... iPhones have got like a screen time counter now, and you can set limits in that too. Some of them turn the colours so that they invert when you press the home button 3 times, and that means that whenever you see the colours like that, it reminds you I'm supposed to be doing work right now, sort of discourages you from using it all the time. So, yeah, it can be a problem, and I'm still struggling with that myself, just trying to make sure that I'm only using it when I need to and focusing on getting some work done. Going on from the types of social media too as well, Facebook... Some people, I think they have to pay for ads to get reach in it, and other people have got around that by making groups for their books or for a series. So then their fans come and join the group, and then when you submit something on the group, they get a notification, don't even have to pay for it. So that's one way around it. I heard there's lots of great Russian outfits that can do some good influencing on Facebook at the moment as well. Instagram is great for illustrators, of course, because you can share pictures. And Twitter is great for writers. And I've made some great connections over both. And Twitter, too, I met a whole bunch of East Coast writers who were all using that and met one of them who's not just a writer, who's also a producer on WB Kids on Channel 9. And we got talking and then I got to be on the TV show last year. So that connection wouldn't have been made without Twitter. So sometimes it's really, really useful.
I think the important thing about social media is to be comfortable with the different platforms, and you do have to adopt some different sort of personae on them. And sometimes writers in particular will actually establish separate pages for their professional life and their personal life. And that, again, that can work if you are disciplined and you do specific things. Other people, if you're very engaged on a particular social media platform, part of your brand or your persona might actually be that your personal and professional is very mixed. My Twitter is very much about me and everything that I do, but a lot of what I do is around books and publishing. So I'm sharing book news and publishing news and talking to authors and talking to booksellers and talking to publishers. But then I'm also posting pictures of my cat and, you know, my old car and the watches that I collect and whatever else. And it all gets sort of mixed in together. So you might not want to do that. And if that's the case, you do need to separate boundaries and then, you know, operate your professional account and your personal account and keep the twain separate.
I think it's great, though, because that stuff shows that you're authentic and it shows that you're not just promoting your own stuff all the time. You're sometimes just going, hey, what are you guys up to? I'm playing with my cat. I'm looking at my watches. I haven't even looked at your Twitter account. I have no idea what it's like. But you know what I mean?
Cats, watches, old cars, yeah. Whiskey, food.
It gives you a chance not to just be talking about your work and saying, buy my book. It's like, hey, this is just my life, yeah. Which is great.
I'd say 100% yes. The more you can throw in of yourself. It's the same, I work with charities in my proper job, and we really recommend that they don't just talk about what they do. If it's someone's birthday in the office and they all bring in a cake, then share that. You know, all these things that are behind the scenes, they give a bit of background, they give a bit of context, and they show that you're actually a really nice person practicing what you preach. So I think you're doing...
I mean, I do know one author who actually had an online stalker, she had to very deliberately lock down her personal social media and then create a professional page. So, I mean, you know, there are potential downsides.
Yeah.
But I think in mixing the personal and the professional is a very good way to go.
One important tip I learned early on was turn off location, geo stamping or whatever it's called, on photos on your phone. Because then otherwise people can download those photos and find out where you live if you took the photo in your house. So stuff like that is really important.
Mm. We've talked a little bit about your readers. How do we actually find readers, Tim? What do authors do to find their readers, and how well should they know them?
Writers should be avid readers themselves, for a start. You all should be reading widely and not only within your field or genre. So some of your first readers can be other writers. And then they're your friends, they're your family, they're people who you have things in common with, and it goes and grows. Your publisher, if you're working with a publisher, will be helping you to find readers. Booksellers will be doing that for you. Librarians, teachers, if it's a children's book. They're all out there. So authors, just be engaged. Don't sit back and wait for the magic to happen. You have to be part of the process.
And Lisa, I know you're quite passionate about knowing your readers.
Yeah, I do. I think you need to know your audience intimately. And I said it before, I think you almost kind of have to feel like friends, because you have to be like-minded. My best advice for doing that is to tell your stories, and, like a broken record in that respect. Tell your stories honestly, and your audience will be attracted to you. They will find you. Again, this is using social media. You can't just sit in your office writing stories and hope that someone catches wind of it. So I like to share those stories on Facebook and Instagram, and it naturally grows. Like attracts like. Facebook groups are also invaluable for finding your readers. So people doing the same thing as you, for growing your network, that sort of thing, really, really valuable. Tell your stories. If you build it, they will come. How many cliches can I get into one answer?
I think we might turn to some of the things that authors might find themselves doing, and one of them might be an elevator pitch, for instance. So, Tim, tell me, what are the right and perhaps the wrong ways to approach a bookseller or a journalist or someone else in the book trade that might help sell a book?
For quite a few years, I worked as a journalist and then as the editor of Books and Publishing magazine, which is the trade publication for the book industry. And we didn't literally have it on the wall, but an absolute mantra was, publisher publishes book is not a story. Writer writes book is not a story. So part of your pitch is, what else? Could be writer overcomes amazing adversity to get first book published. Publisher pre-sells international rights for book to 17 countries. So there's got to be something other than writer writes book to get anyone's attention. Journalists in particular are very, very time poor. And nowadays, the reality is they need the story to come to them, and in a lot of cases. So package your pitch. Work with your publisher and publicist, if you have one, or work on your own to develop a story. And depending upon what your book is, you can link it into contemporary events, to a theme, to a topic. And it might seem counterintuitive, but sometimes you can actually package a story to pitch to journalists on things other than your book that include your book. You might say, look, I've written a book about topic X, and here are three or four other books on similar topics. You might want to consider a story where you look at the broader topic and interview each of us as authors and experts on that topic. That could work as well in fiction as in non-fiction, just as one example. Mm-hmm. Booksellers similarly see thousands and thousands of books every month. The very best advice I can give is leave them alone in the 6 weeks before Christmas. Just do not even wave at them. Something like 30 or 40% of the books that are sold in the whole year happen between Melbourne Cup Day and Christmas Eve. And publishers will think of their schedules very carefully as to whether a book is a Christmas book, whether it's going to fit into that huge rush, or whether it's actually much better off having some free air in March or June or some other time of the year. And again, don't front up to your local bookshop when your book's out and do a sales pitch. You should already know your bookseller. They should be as excited about a local author's book coming out as you are. Don't front up with three copies under your arm, and particularly not if you're a self-publishing author, and say, hi, here's my book, please sell it. You should have been coming in every second week for 9 months talking to your bookseller and saying, oh, gee, look, here's the cover mock-up. What do you think of this? Or, it's great, I got the edits back from my editor and it was really improved the story, and that the clock's ticking, it's only 3 months to go. So, yeah, build relationships, don't just storm in and don't do the sales pitch.
Mm. Once you've got an interview with a journalist, for instance, your publicist's done it, or you've cyber-stalked them like James and got yourself on television, you've shared cat pictures.
Yep.
How do you prepare for an interview with a journalist? That's for all of you.
I had one recently where it was for the group book launch of some kids' books with Freer Press last year, and myself and Ian Much were going on RTR radio for a little interview, and I forgot to bring a printout of the briefing note that Claire and the other people in the comms department had so lovingly and prepared and sweated over to get all that information together. And so the interviewer said, and who are the other people on the panel with you? And I couldn't remember everyone's names because I had a six-month-old baby at the time. I had no memory, but also I'd just forgotten to bring the paper. So stuff like that, just like bring stuff to jot your memory if you need. It's really important. Yes, know what you're going to talk about.
I would say have a few anecdotes pre-prepared. Journalists love stories. They love those little sound bites. And you can probably guess what they're going to ask. They have a list of pretty standard questions. They're not going to stray far from the script. So when they ask you who your inspiration is, have a little anecdote ready. It will make their job easier and you'll come across a lot better.
It can depend also who you're dealing with, what kind of media or what level of media. I was quite surprised the first time I was asked to go on what was then the Radio National Book Show. It used to be on every day. It's now kind of what Books and Arts. It's gotten a little bit diluted. About a topic in the book industry, it must no doubt one of the innumerable parallel importation debates or something like that many years ago. And the producer of the radio show first rang me and said, would you like to come on tomorrow? I said, sure. Do I need to go in person? Will it be a phone interview? Then once it was agreed, they rang me back and basically did the interview already. And then when I was sitting in the radio studio opposite the quite well-known presenter, she basically read back the conversation I'd already had with the producer. So sometimes it's not as spontaneous or as live as you might think, and it's quite pre-planned. Other times you do go in completely blind, as it were. So, yes, having your own story prepared, being prepared to push things to your own agenda, not being pushy and not ignoring the journalist's questions or intention. But, yeah, you should know what you want to get out of the interview or the experience as much as they do.
Now, I can keep asking questions. I've got a couple more, but I wondered if you guys might like to ask a question. Does anyone have a question for our panel?
In case people didn't hear the question, it was whether you can utilise the same material or the same story in different platforms.
That's a really good question. And no, you can't, because you've got a slightly different audience. So if you look at Facebook, Facebook is a demographic of mainly females, and it's actually females probably from about 45 upwards, whereas Instagram is, again, females but younger, and they're more aspirational. So you're going to be telling roughly the same story, but you do have to keep that audience in the back of your mind each time, that it's slightly different. So you're going to have to tweak it, because if you just roll out the same generic content, it's going to be off-putting to people. And again, LinkedIn is more professional. Twitter is that constant networking with other writers. And so, yeah, it is different.
And, yeah, there are different audiences you need to consider. I mean, you know, I teach professional communications, and sort of lesson one is, who is your audience? Where's your message going to? What does that message need to contain to attract them? And then also authenticity. People can tell very quickly if you've just lumped something together and copied it in lots of places.
So the question is, how you deal with negative feedback on social media?
Yes, it's a really good question, because I've had my fair share, and I'm not thick-skinned enough. You almost need a crash course in how to deal with negativity. As soon as you personalise yourself, people are very quick to pass judgment and to write negative comments. But as soon as you come in there and say, hey, such and such, I'm really sorry you feel this way, signed from Lisa, and they can put a face to this person they were kind of anonymously trolling, it diffuses the situation quite quickly. So I'm at a point now where, touch wood, I don't get... I tend not to get negativity, and I don't get trolled anymore. Because I think I've levelled the playing field. Everyone knows where they stand. Yeah, it's a risk. I don't suppose any of you are going to go out courting controversy. If you are, then you're going to have to be open to trolls. If you're out there just telling your stories, promoting your book, then I don't think you're setting yourself up for negative publicity. So it's how you portray yourself as well.
Have you got any other questions? Yep, at the back. So the question was about vlogs.
Again, if that's your strength and that's where your audience is, then absolutely go for it. But again, I kind of think that there's nothing worse than bad video. So if you're not good at it, you know what I mean? And publishers, they dabble in book trailers sometimes, where they'll produce a short clip to promote the book. Some of them are really great and they do a really good job and they get shared a lot, and others are just really, really awful and they probably shouldn't have done it in the first place. Mm. And they can actually... Well, they don't do much harm because they don't go very far. Mm. They just disappear. So, yeah, if you're good at it, if you're a confident performer, or if you have some skills... I mean, you know, most 10-year-olds can put together a very professional YouTube video in the time it takes you to learn how to turn the camera on. So, yeah, you know, that's another good outsourcing thing. Get the kids to do it. Get them to do a claymation dinosaur version of your story or something, and that may well work very, very well for you.
For illustrators, it's really handy nowadays, when lots of us are experimenting with apps like Procreate on iPad. It's got a built-in time-lapse feature, so you can then export a video of time-lapse of you doing the drawing on there. And it's very easy just to share that on social media. Seeing that a lot at the moment, and I always find that fascinating, seeing how an illustrator has made little choices throughout their whole process of making an illustration. Oh, we actually did 3 versions of it and rubbed them all out entirely before getting the right one. Cool, so they make mistakes just like me. That's good. I don't know, there's something like a great a leveller about that. You can't hide when it's just a video, you know, unless you've edited it really well. You can't really hide. You're just showing what it's like to do your illustrations. I think that's great. It's sharing information.
Another thing to think about is that media, or social medias, online medias in particular, wax and wane. A few years ago, everybody wanted to have a personal website and a blog, and we were all jumping from blog to blog to blog to comment on things. Now it's so much more centralised on a few sites that, you know, you almost certainly do need to have a personal site, but it's almost like a site of record. Mm-hmm. That's where you're going to put your bio and your best headshot and the covers of your books. But then you're going to be linking, you know, you're going to be active on social media rather than being active on your own website. The people have been very successful also in building email lists, which seems very old-fashioned now. You kind of go full circle. But you may well do those sort of personalised update things to originally a few dozen, then a few hundred, and then ultimately to, you know, quite a few thousand of your readers. And they feel invested. They go, I've actually got an email from my favourite author, you know, telling me about what they're up to. So, yeah, you just need to watch the fashions of different things coming and going.
Well, we're bang on time. So thank you, Lisa Sheeran, James Foley and Tim Coronel. I think it's been a fantastic panel session.
Thank you.